This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Over the past few weeks, we've discussed the dawn of the atomic age at the Trinity test site in New Mexico and the political and physical effects of Hiroshima. Today, on the 60th anniversary of the second attack at Nagasaki, how the atom bombs affected culture and self-image in Japan and here in the U.S. One of Japan's leading artists says his country's utter military defeat and its ensuing dependence on the U.S. led to the creation of the monster Godzilla, to the video game Dragon Ball, and even to Hello Kitty. Artist Takashi Murakami curated a New York exhibit called Little Boy. The name refers both to the bomb that dropped on Hiroshima and to his view of the post-war relationship between Japan and the U.S. The exhibit at the Japan Society focused on art inspired by the youth-driven otaku or geek culture. That art includes anime cartoons plus cute playthings like Hello Kitty and the considerably less cute video games. Today we'll examine the cultural aftermath of the bomb with a curator from the Japan Society, with a professor who looks at America's relationship to the bomb, and with a Japanese producer who talked with both U.S. and Japanese teenagers about the bomb. Later this hour, we'll hear the voice of another cultural icon. Actor Jim Dale joins us with the voices of Harry Potter and company. But first, the popular arts 60 years after Little Boy and Fat Man. How did those bombs shape post-war culture? Is the post-apocalypse an atomic echo? How did the bombs fit into America's self-image? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address totn@npr.org. Linda Hoagland joins us now. She helped translate the Japan Society's Little Boy exhibit. She's also the senior film curator at the Japan Society. She's working on an upcoming film series called After War, and she's nice enough to take time from her vacation to talk to us from the island of Kauai in Hawaii. Thanks very much for being on the program today.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. If there's one thing in Japanese culture that tells you immediately this is after Hiroshima, this is after Nagasaki, what would it be?
Well, I think we would have to start with Godzilla. In the original Japanese version of the film, the Godzilla, the monster, was posited as having been awakened from centuries-old slumber by hydrogen testing in the Pacific. And one Japanese filmmaker posits, he's in his late 40s today, that the most terrifying thing about Godzilla were the extras who fled the monster, because they were all people who had survived the firebombings, if not Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the terror on their faces was real, not faked. And that through that, through these kinds of popular animated and manga and films, animation and manga and films, the terror and the aftermath of the war was transmitted to succeeding generations.
I've heard it described, and whether this is accurate or not, you tell me. A lot of American films end with big explosions. A lot of Japanese films begin with big explosions.
Yes. Well, because Japan was the is the only country to have experienced an atomic bomb, perhaps they felt that they had the right to just start a film with the big explosion of the bomb. There are several famous entertainment films. These are not documentaries, but made for popular entertainment that just start with the bomb and the mushroom cloud. And that's where the story starts, because Japan has lived through it and can speak about the aftermath, whereas the United States, never having lived through it, must end with the bomb and the big explosion, because we're not really comfortable looking with what happened after.
Now, you worked closely with this artist that we've been talking about, curator Takashi Murakami. How does this so-called otaku, the geeky art driven by youth market, how does that relate to a war that, obviously traumatic 60 years ago, though, long before they were born?
Right. His thesis is that the violence of the atomic bombs and the war in general, because it could not find an outlet in the fine arts in post-war Japan, made their way into the consciousness of the next generation via these animation and manga. Atom Boy would be a great example of an extremely popular children's program that directly references the atomic bomb. What happened is that these children watched these television entertainments and read these manga, and then grew up in the 60s and the 70s subliminally aware of the sort of ensuing issues. in addition to, I mean, what happened, the otaku kind of emerged in the late 70s as adults. They were steeped in these images, and in Murakami's words, he characterizes otaku, super geeks, if you will, by a relentless self-reference to a humiliated self. They were obsessed with what was then considered uncool, these homegrown cultures of anime and manga. In addition, then, what otaku grew up with were the fundamental contradictions of why Japan remained dependent on the country that dropped the atomic bombs and defeated Japan militarily. Also, why Japan, one of the few countries in the world, one of two countries in the world that has a peace constitution forswearing war, also has a self-defense force. The parents of these children were at a loss to explain these fundamental contradictions to their children because they themselves couldn't understand them.
Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email is totn@npr.org. We're talking today about atomic echoes in Japanese culture. Later, we'll get to Americans as well. And let's begin by talking with Steve. Steve joins us on the line from Salem, Oregon.
Yeah, I have a question. I'm interested in the self-loathing culture that the Japanese perceive themselves in. In light of the news censorships and blackouts that were happening, especially from 43 on, when they weren't getting any information that they were this defeated, losing nation, that everything was fine, that they were winning the war. When did all this start? How did they, you know, what was the essence? What was of the time frame? Mm-hmm.
Well, you're correct. It was Japanese military censorship through the early 40s, and then, of course, there was the United States occupation censorship, which prohibited really any images of the war or the bombs. And so it wasn't until really the mid-50s that any of these images could be legitimately portrayed. And so I think, in a sense, it took the Japanese a long time to catch up with not only the legacy of their own militarism, but also the legacy of the bombs and their humiliating defeat.
Thank you.
Steve, thanks for the call. Let's get another voice in on the conversation. Mariana Turgovnik is a cultural critic and the author of a new book called The War Complex, World War II in Our Time. She's with us from the Duke University News Service Studios. Thanks very much for being with us on the program.
Happy to be here, Neil.
We've been talking with Linda Hoagland about some of the effects on Japanese culture. How do you think the bombs manifest themselves in American culture?
Well, there are lots of ways that the bomb manifests themselves in American culture. The initial reaction in the United States was one of great joy that the war had ended. And that kind of emphasized the fact that Pearl Harbor had initiated the war and that there had been lots of Japanese atrocities. And that continues to appear in American culture. There are people who feel no regret about the dropping of the bomb. There are even people who feel proud of the dropping of the bomb. But at the same time that this feeling took shape, there was a reaction which I would call a strong reaction of apprehension. A lot of the clergymen in the United States and a lot of intellectuals warned the United States not to be too proud and warned that there was something to fear now that the energy of the universe had been tapped for purposes of war. And that apprehension reaction, I think, is the key thing which has continued in American culture. And even people who feel proud of the atomic bomb, I think, nonetheless, have been influenced by the fact that apprehension becomes a basic feature of American life.
Mm-hmm. Did that have to do with unleashing the atomic genie, if you will, or the fears of the Cold War, which followed not long thereafter?
It had to do with both. The initial statement made by Robert Oppenheimer, who had developed the bomb, quoted from two figures in the Bhagavad Gita. One of them refers to the radiance of 1,000 suns, the forces of creation, and the other refers to the energies of destruction. Krishna says, "I am time grown old to destroy the world." And I think that feeling that something basic had changed was one thing. But of course, some people think that one of the points of the atomic bombings was to demonstrate to our future Cold War enemy that we possessed the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, led to the apprehension that other people would possess the atomic bomb and would use them against us. So a lot of Cold War energy is devoted to preventing the Soviets, who developed the atomic bomb in 49, and then devoted to preventing the Soviets from developing the hydrogen bomb, which they do very quickly after we develop the hydrogen bomb. So there's always this idea that it might happen to us, and what would we do if it happened to us?
Mm. Let's get another caller on the line. Robert calling us from Queens in New York.
Hi, yes, hi. In regards to this concept of self-loathing for Japan and modern Japan, I don't see its connection. Being in Japan, I noticed that it's, you know, other than the normal understanding that it is a very patriarchal society, that this idea of self-loathing seems to be, I would say, antiquated. You have an administration now that is actually very forthright in its idea that it can project itself as a power. Do you think that the idea of self-loathing is more of an outdated premise at this point, considering Japan's very long history?
Linda Hoagland, I think that's to you.
Yes. Well, yes, certainly the current Japanese administration is beginning to rattle its sabers, but I think in part it's a direct reaction to the fact that Japan has for 60 years been utterly militarily dependent on the United States, and that what Murakami posits is that this military political dependence on the United States leads to a sense of impotence. And it's this sense of impotence that the current Japanese administration is attempting to exploit.
Japan's neighbors don't feel they are impotent. Can we comment on that?
Well, that's Japan's neighbors. We're talking about Japan's self-perception rather than their neighbors' perception, which is considerably different, Robert. Just extend the thought for a second. This you take, or the artist takes, even to something like Hello Kitty.
Yes, the sense of cuteness of an entire nation anxious about growing up and taking responsibility because the nation state itself has never really grown up to take responsibility also for its its aggression into China and into Asia, and so it's left kind of in limbo as a nation state.
We're going to continue our conversation after we return from a short break. We're talking about the long shadow left on culture by the atomic bombs that fell 60 years ago in Japan, and how the rubble of Hiroshima and Nagasaki may have produced a global pop culture so popular here in the U.S. today. When we come back, we'll talk with a documentary producer about the human toll of the bombings. Are there ways you see the bomb reflected in pop culture on either side of the Pacific? 800-989-8255 or send us an email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 60 years ago today, an American B-29 bomber loosed the Fat Man plutonium bomb over the Japanese city of Nagasaki. We're talking today about the cultural impact of the two atomic bomb explosions in Japan. To see photos of the arts of Japan's exploding subculture and learn more about the cultural fallout of the atomic bombs, you can visit our website at npr.org. Our guests are Linda Hoagland, who grew up in Japan, now a senior film curator for the Japan Society in New York, and also with us is Mariana Torgovnik, author of The War Complex, World War II in Our Time. And, of course, you're invited to join us if you're an artist, painter, musician, writer. Do you see an impact of the shadow of the war in the Pacific? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, totn@npr.org. Here's a phone caller, Philip. Philip on the line with us from Michigan.
Hello, everyone. My question, I guess, or comment is, you look at Japan from prior to World War II, 1937, 1935 prior, it was basically the code of the war, the Bushido code, that was prevalent. And then I guess now, and I can see where your guests are, I can see the comments that your guests are making are accurate, that they go to this cartoon culture almost. I was stationed over there when I was in the Navy a little bit, and it really is prevalent. But, and then you look at the art, the early Japanese art with the lovely lines and the emphasis on form, like the one pine tree and stuff, and then you look at the later culture from the 60s, 70s, and 80s on. And I'd just like to have your comments on that.
Mm-hmm. Linda Hoagland.
Well, I think, I guess what I would say is that part of what Japan is struggling with is that, indeed, Japanese culture was a very much a warrior culture and a Bushido culture, and this led directly into their aggression into China in the early 30s. There's no question about that. What happened with the imposition of the U.S. peace constitution and the U.S. occupation, all of that came to a completely screeching halt and was deemed inappropriate, and so there was a new democracy was imposed, and Japanese had to completely reinvent themselves. And I suppose some people would argue that they threw the baby out with the bathwater and that Japanese culturally are somewhat in limbo now, wondering if they had to jettison and exercise everything from before World War II.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Thank you, Philip. Let me ask you, Mariana Turgovnik, I know you've written about how American ideals of heroism are so evident in all those movies from World War II. In a way, they don't. It's very difficult to get those to jibe with the end of the war and Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Well, it is in lots of ways, and one of the things which is notable in American films is that movies about Japan, the Pacific arena, tended to disappear after the Vietnam era. When Saving Private Ryan came out, there was a film about the Pacific, and it didn't succeed with the populace, although it did succeed with critics. And I think it was because Vietnam tended to evoke images of the nuclear destruction. There were scenes in it of flame bombing, and that just didn't play well. However, the atomic bombings have made their way, I think, in a peculiar way into American pop culture as well. Cold War anxieties were reflected in a lot of sci-fi invasion films.
Sure.
And one of the things that I've noticed this summer and this past season is a number of plots in the popular media that have to do with the massive destruction of American culture, oftentimes with forces from within American culture. Alias, the popular series for teenagers and young women, ran a very extensive series about this miraculous ball that would produce a violent reaction where people would destroy each other. 24 ran a very, very elegant series about a Islamist group which was plotting all kinds of destruction. The War of Worlds not only includes that plot but also refers to the terrorist threat and sort of brings to the surface a lot of things that have been latent in America's reaction to terrorism. And I went to see Batman Begins last night, and there it was again. So it's really been quite astonishing to see this theme of destruction, and in Batman Begins, astonishingly enough, destruction that Gotham deserves from the point of view of the potential destroyers.
Let's get another caller on the line. Kim joins us. Kim calling from Flagstaff, Arizona.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that it's part of our slang vocabulary. For instance, we say nuke 'em as a way to take care of a problem, to end a problem. And I think that was pretty evident right after 9/11, for instance. We just wanted to say nuke 'em to take care of the people that had attacked us. And yet that really wouldn't have solved anything. But yet that's our reflex as Americans.
I wonder, Mariana Turgovnik, have you done any research into the etymology of nuke 'em?
Well, it's obviously a contraction of nuclear, but one of the things that's true is that language tends to inform the way we think. I mean, if you speak about nuking them, we even talk about microwaving things as nuking it. And given all of the fear and loathing that nuclear destruction has created in the United States and the decades spent on making sure that nuclear deterrence would take place and nuclear disarmament would take place, it's actually kind of interesting, as your caller suggests, that that's become a casual idiom, meaning anything from destroy them to microwave it.
Kim, thanks for the observation. Appreciate it. Later today, a documentary called Original Child Bomb about the human cost of the nuclear bomb airs on the Sundance Channel. In it, the filmmakers spoke to a class of New York City teenagers after showing archival footage of Nagasaki and Hiroshima before and after the bomb. Here's one student's reaction.
Possibility of any kind of nuclear war. I don't think it's even remotely any type of reality for this generation. It's something that's of the past, and it seems like it's something that is in the future, but not something that affects us.
For a new generation, this film suggests that this is the legacy of the bomb. Joining us now is Ayana Osada. She is co-producer of the documentary Original Child Bomb. She's with us by phone from New York City. Nice of you to join us today on Talk of the Nation.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
What did you find from your interviews of young people, both in the U.S. and Japan?
Generally, the students, teenagers in New York, were shocked and saddened by the tragedy that took place both in Nagasaki and Hiroshima and were or had been unaware of the details, at least, of the tragedies. And in Japan, of course, we all grew up learning much more about these incidents, tragedies, than I believe the children in the U.S. But even the 13-year-old Japanese boy who worked with us on the film was somewhat afraid to actually go to Hiroshima with our director and was, again, saddened to be there and to feel the pain of many, many hibakusha, the victims, who are still alive today, who are still suffering 60 years later.
I wonder, we've been talking a lot about the influences of the atomic bomb explosions on Japanese culture. What do you think, what you found out from those kids in New York, what do you think that says about how Americans deal with our atomic past?
Again, as your panelists had been talking before, there is a sense of impotence, incompetence, and an extreme dependency of Japan on the its big brother, the U.S., who constituted the peace constitution after the war and so forth. And so Japan always, I knew growing up in Japan, knew that Japan looked up to America for its culture, for its subculture, for many, many things. And so it was kind of a given, I felt, that the American people, young people today, just felt like Japan was a little brother and a friendly country. And they were, again, shocked to find out the details, and really each story having an incredibly emotional sense of what are the consequences of the bombs.
Mm-hmm. As a Japanese person, as you said, you grew up there, I wonder, do you agree with Murakami's argument about post-war Japan? It sounds as if you do.
I do, and I think to go further, this whole otaku culture or the timid expression of the hidden anger and the questioning of these contradictions that Linda had eloquently expressed before,
mm-hmm.
I think all of this is sort of pointing us to come to a point where we could maybe find out what exactly happened and what are the pains that people felt on both sides, and that I really think that had we recognized that the pains do not have to be mutually exclusive, as in you can be patriotic Japanese or American and still know what happened
mm-hmm.
on these days, and that's what we're trying to do with our film.
I wonder, Japan would have been devastated by the firebombings alone, even if the atomic bombings had never happened. Japan would have been defeated if the atomic bombs had never been dropped. What particularly about Japanese culture do you think reflects the atomic aspect of the defeat that did happen?
I believe things such as the Tetsuwan Atomu, I guess Linda had mentioned this. There are many cartoons and animes that deal with the nuclear Armageddon, particularly, that have specific images of the mushroom clouds and,
mm-hmm.
and also mutations and also radiation sickness that follow, which is what happened in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, which is why we still have people who suffer from leukemia and all kinds of cancers because of that. For many, many years and generations, possibly, to go.
Hmm. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Elizabeth. Elizabeth calling us from Tempe, Arizona.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm actually calling about that, the graphic novels. When I was in school, and we were learning about World War II, I had read, well, we called them comic books, but it was called, I think it's Barefoot Gen. I'm not sure if I'm saying it right. But it had such a tremendous impact on the way that I understood the effects of the nuclear bomb and what actually happened to the people, as it's told from the point of view of a young child, and seeing these graphic images almost in comic book form of people with the skin just melting off their face. It was something that that just had a huge impact on the way I viewed the war and what happened. It was no longer an abstraction. It was very clear. And I was wondering if you could talk about things like that and unfortunately how maybe rare that education is in our culture.
Well, for the first part, let's go to Linda Hoagland.
Yeah, thank you for bringing up Barefoot Gen. In addition to being a graphic novel, it's also a very, very powerful animated film. And the footage from that film of the moment when the author, who was 5 years old, looked down at a stone and the bomb exploded behind him, killing his parents, is to me the most powerful image of the atomic bomb that I've ever seen. And it actually led me to muse whether or not the power of animation in Japan is a direct result of the bomb and trying to devise a way of looking at what is unwatchable. so that it was not, it's not an accident that animation became so popular, because it became the only way that you could actually look at and imagine what had happened in the Armageddon. What do you think, Ayanna?
Thank you. I really appreciate the mentioning of Barefoot Gen, because the footage from Barefoot Gen of the moment of the impact is in our film, Original Child Bomb, because the author, the artist Keiji Nakazawa and Chubunsha, the publisher, has kindly given us permission to use that footage and in our film. And I really would strongly urge anyone to, you know, who has the chance to watch our film, to look at this scene, because like Linda said, I believe this is one of the images that has always stayed with me as a child growing up, because we all watched this or read this comic book.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the atomic echoes of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, 60 years after the bombing of Nagasaki. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Mariana Turgovnik, I wanted to bring you in on this phone call as well, on the aspect that Elizabeth was talking about in terms of education of Americans.
The education of Americans on the atomic bombings is very spotty, and one of the things that I found in my work is that a lot of World War II memory resides through the family, and a lot of World War II memory is different depending on which coast you grew up in. On the West Coast, people are much more likely to be attuned to things like Japanese, the internment camps for Japanese Americans, and much more likely to be attuned to the atomic bombings. On the East Coast, those things are certainly known, and the internment camps increasingly known since the 1970s, there tends to be an emphasis upon Holocaust education, it's education into the Holocaust, which tends to come first. As I say, a lot of World War II memory comes through the family, and the film which was done sounds absolutely amazing, but it would be interesting to see whether West Coast teenagers would say exactly the same thing that the East Coast teenagers said.
Both will have a chance to see it later today when it's on its American debut on the Sundance Channel. I did want to ask you, Linda Hoagland, you're a senior film curator as well. You're making doing a project now on Japanese films after war. What characterizes the difference between Japanese films before and after the war?
Well, I would say that it's not so much a broad characterization of the difference. I mean, certainly during the war, there were plenty of propaganda films that were made, and there wasn't that long a stretch before the war between silent films and talkies, although Japan already had a very strong film studio business in place. The series that I've curated that we're going to be showing at the Japan Society starting on September 27th after war simply illustrates my position, which is that, in fact, Japanese filmmakers have grappled with memories of war, memories of aggression, memories of defeat and of the bomb in really literally hundreds of films that deal with the war directly and indirectly. And there are so many of these films. And I suppose part of it is that Japan is constantly being accused of never having come to terms with its own aggression and with the war. And I would argue that many filmmakers, and not just art filmmakers and documentarians, but also popular entertainment directors, have really grappled with the war in such imaginative ways that we're just going to show six of them, and we hope that any of you who are in New York or not will come to New York to come and see these films.
Let's see if we can get one more caller in before we have to go. Aaron calling from Mesa, Arizona.
I was kind of interested as I was thinking about it. My grandparents and my parents were alive when the bombs were dropped, and you're stating that, you know, the culture in Japan became a self-loathing culture in the young people directly after that. I find it interesting, as the caller before me, when she was explaining that, you know, comic books and things taught her about what happened, we had also very graphic teachings in our school about what happened and how horrible it was. And I mean, from fourth grade onward. And it's interesting to me that my generation is the one having the issues with the self-loathing, you know, with the grunge music and, you know, really negative self-images and things like that.
We just have a few seconds left, Mariana Turgovnik. I wondered if you wanted to respond to that.
Well, it wasn't clear to me where the caller went to school, so it's a little hard to respond to that. But it does. It's oftentimes generations that don't directly experience it will be responding to the image of things. So, in a sense, it may not be that surprising that it would turn up in a later generation.
Aaron, thanks for the phone call. I'm sorry we didn't have time to give it the full amount of time that it needed, but we appreciate it. And thanks to our guests, Linda Hoagland, who was kind enough to join us from vacation, senior film curator for the Japan Society. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mariana Turgovnik joined us from the studios at Duke University, cultural critic there and professor. We appreciate your time today.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
And Ayana Osada, good luck with the movie.
Thank you.
It debuts later today on the Sundance Channel. When we come back from a short break, Jim Dale, the voice of Harry Potter. It's Talk of the Nation after the news.